though communication medium is error tolerant, and through this talk, we'll be trying to think about noise, mediums of communication which are extremely noisy, not that much so. So the question that came up around the middle of the 20th century was how do we overcome noise and achieve reliable communication?
There were a couple of very seminal works which sort of set the mathematical tone for the rest of the research in the arena. The first of those was that of Shannon.
The first challenge over here is to understand what is the mathematical model behind, how do you model this problem mathematically. And Shannon introduced a very elegant framework where he said, let's model the noise as if it's a probabilistic effect. So the channel, let's say, is transmitting bits. It transmits every bit accurately with probability 1 minus p. And with some probability p, think of it as some small number between 0 and a half. The bit gets flipped and you get the other. So you transmit a 0, you see a 1. And let's assume, for simplicity, there are many, many channels that Shannon could have studied and did. But let's assume for simplicity that we're considering this very simple channel where the bits are flipped independently. So what happens on the ith bit that we transmit is completely independent of what happens to the ith plus first bit and the nth bit, etc. And the question is, what kind of communication can you carry out on this channel?
For a while it was considered, probably, I mean, it was a popular belief before Shannon's work that really if you want to achieve reliable communication, you want to transmit, say, k bits, then, and you want the entire k bit sequence to be received accurately by the receiver, well, you should probably transmit each bit repeated log k times. That would be about the right thing, and that would work well. Oops. So one guesses that.
Carlos,
I doubt if the table would be issued at this point. It's probably going somewhere back in the office.
I turned off all over again.
So, you want to go up further then? Wow. Thank you.
Yeah. I won't turn it off this time.
Thanks. So it appears something was wrong with my laptop after all. Sorry about that. So Shannon was modeling the errors in this channel by say a single parameter. What is the probability with which a bit is flipped? And among other things that Shannon proposed, something that we take for granted today, but something which would not probably be very natural at that time, given that computers did not exist and even a very rudimentary notion of communication was hardly implemented, Shannon proposed two algorithms in order to implement the process of communication. Before sending information, the sender should encode the information, expand the k-bit sequence into a longer n-bit sequence, and then transmit this n-bit string on the channel. The receiver, on the other hand, would decode the n-bit sequence, which is somewhat longer than the message that it's expecting, and then compress it to the k-bit sequence, hopefully in the process somehow squeezing out the error. That's the physical analogy we think of. How it can be done or have to be done is the essential question. However, Shannon proposed we should consider these two algorithms, consider them as variables. What kinds of algorithms could you have? And try to figure out how well can you use the channel. What is the notion of utility of the channel? Well, the ratio. You really are sending k bits, but in order to do that, you're using the channel which transmits a single bit each time, you're using it n times. So you want to use as large a ratio of k over n as possible. At the same time, you have to deal with a fraction p of errors. How can you what kind of relationships can you get between this ratio k over n and p? And Shannon gave this beautiful meta-theorem. There was many, many special instantiations of which he proved. And these theorems said basically that every channel in a very broad class has a capacity associated with it, some positive real number. And if you try to use this channel at rates below this capacity, then you'll be successful. And if you're trying to transmit it at rates above this capacity, it will be utterly unsuccessful. And in both cases, he said, basically, if you're transmitting at rate slightly less than this capacity, you'll be successful with exponentially large probability, exponentially large in the length of the messages that you're transmitting. And on the other hand, if you're trying to transmit above this capacity, then you will be making errors with probability which is all but exponentially small. So you're really going to be utterly unsuccessful. An example of this kind of an effect, let's go back to this binary symmetric channel where each bit is bit flipped with probability p. And Shannon's result showed that this channel has a capacity which is 1 minus the entropy function of p. Entropy function of p is a function which I haven't formally defined here. Let me just tell you what the implications of this result are for some very interesting, you know, from choices of p which are interesting. If p equals 0, what does that mean? Every bit that you transmit is communicated faithfully. We know that these things don't exist in practice, but mathematically we can define them. And of course, over here there is nothing to do. You just transmit bits as they are. So the capacity is 1. Shannon's theorem says so. On the other hand, if the bit flipping probability is a half, so you transmit a bit which is a 0, the receiver receives either 0 or 1 with equal probability. You transmit a 1, the receiver receives 0 or 1 with equal probability. The receiver's signal has no correlation at all with what you're sending. It could toss a coin and simulate this channel. So presumably this channel should have no capacity, no communication capacity, and indeed Shannon's theorem says exactly that. In between, as p varies from 0 to half, the capacity of this channel decreases in a monotone fashion. What does that imply? In particular, if 49% of the bits that you're transmitting are flipped, and 51% are not getting flipped. So there's a very tiny correlation between what you're sending and what the receiver is receiving. One would think that this kind of a channel is almost not utilizable, but Shannon's theorem says no, it is utilizable, and in fact you get some positive capacity. Maybe in order to utilize this channel fruitfully, you might have to expand every bit into 1,000 bits. But nevertheless, there is some positive capacity associated with this channel. It can be utilized. And indeed, these kinds of very, very large rates of error are not
unreasonable. When you send out a satellite with an extremely low power transmitter sitting in it, and it's trying to beam its signals back to Earth, well, presumably there'll be a large amount of error, cosmic radiation, whatever, what have you, that will introduce a large amount of error in the communication, but nevertheless there'll be some correlation between what the channel is, what the sender is sending and what the receiver is receiving. And this correlation, Shannon's theorem says, is good enough for you to be able to utilize this channel fruitfully.
And this became a model for much of the practice in communication since then. There were a few gaps, of course, with Shannon's theorem. You couldn't use it as it is because it was completely non-constructive.
The coding algorithm that Shannon suggested was just run through all possible messages and figure out which one could have been the one that was sent. So this is not an algorithmic result. In fact, if decoding at exponential time sounds bad, encoding was even worse. It was doubly exponential time. He said, pick an encoding function among the entire space of all encoding functions at random. So that's doubly exponentially large space to be looking over at. So this theorem was hardly constructive, but nevertheless became the basis for future searches. In 1955, before the notion of polynomial time was developed, Elias gave essentially a polynomial time algorithm which could utilize every channel which has positive capacity at some positive rate. So this might not match Shannon's theorem constructively, but it could say if this channel has capacity, you can use it. Not at the rate Shannon suggests, but something lower. Later in 1966, even at this time, the notion of polynomial time was still only being, you know, sort of mulled over in theoretical computer science. Dave Forney gave a very, very constructive result. It actually achieved polynomial time algorithms with exponentially small error probability that would achieve any rate less than the capacity. Okay, so you can get as good, so you can match Shannon's theorem algorithmically efficiently. The encoding would be polynomial time, the decoding would be polynomial time, and this was virtually the gold standard. And modern results following, in particular, a work of Spielman's in 96, leads to actually linear time algorithms for all of these problems. So these problems look like they're wonderfully well solved. So what else do we have to talk about? Well, I want to talk about the notion of errors. Shannon's notion of errors, that errors are independent and probabilistic, is a somewhat benign notion of errors. One could consider many scenarios where errors are not independent. You could still model them probabilistically, but over time we are starting to encounter notions of communication channels where the error does not appear to be oblivious to the encoding mechanism and to the decoding mechanism and to what is being sent. There are lots of active participants in the communication channels nowadays, and they tend to intrude in a much more perverse manner. So how do we model such sources of error? One model proposed by Hamming, also around the same time as Shannon, in fact these works were interdependent chronologically, he proposed that we should model errors adversarially. So some adversary is going to come along, figure out how you're planning to encode messages, how the receiver is planning to decode messages, and then say, well, this is the message that we want to transmit, and then say, this is the error that I want to introduce after you've encoded it. So comes along in an extremely obstructive manner and comes along and tries to say if it can ruin communication. Even under this very, very perverse notion of errors, you can correct errors. It's actually remarkable, and you can actually correct a positive fraction of errors with very good rate. However, the numbers are not quite the same. Let me tell you a little bit more about Hamming's method of studying this thing. Rather than focusing on the encoding function and the decoding function, which are the only objects that Shannon has talked about, Hamming looked at what was the essential characteristic of this encoding function which makes encoding work. And he said, well, it doesn't really matter how you choose to represent your messages, what the exact mapping is from the image, from the k-letter strings to the n-letter strings that you're building. All that matters is which set of n-letter strings you get mapped to. What are the all possible strings that you might ever try to transmit on the channel? This we call the error-correcting code. This introduces one of the themes of the title today. And this is the object that he studied. And he said, well, if this code includes strings which are too close to each other, where you have to change very few coordinates to get from one valid sequence that was transmitted by the sender to another potential valid sequence that could have been transmitted by the sender, then errors are inevitable. And this notion he formalized by looking at this thing, the distance that he defined, which we since call the Hamming distance. The Hamming distance between two strings x and y is the number of coordinates that you have to change the string x into the string y. It's a symmetric notion, it satisfies the triangle inequality, it allows you to start thinking about these messages that you're sending on the channel in some abstract geometric space, and that became very useful in studying error correction capacities of various channels. What Hamming noticed was that if you want to transmit messages very accurately, then you should try to build error correcting codes. Codes where every pair of two transmissions, n letter strings that you try to transmit, are very far away. Any pair that you try to look at and compare, you have to change the string in many, many coordinates to get from one to the other. So he looked at the minimum overall possible strings that he might transmit of the distance between them, and that he called the distance of the codes. Hamming noticed, and this is a fairly straightforward observation, that if you have codes of distance d, so any pair of strings that you are likely to transmit differ in at least d coordinates, then not only can you detect less than d errors, but you can even correct half as many errors. So abstractly, you're considering transmitting either this point or that. The adversary comes along if you transmit this point, moves it to something which is within d over 2 of this original point. But you can still tell you which was the closest point, and not in a computationally effective sense, but at least you can reason that out given infinite time, and you can figure out what might have been the message that was transmitted. So a code of distance d can correct any pattern of d minus 1 over 2 errors, and that led to a lot of developments in the adversarial model of errors. So you can correct a lot of errors if you can build good codes, and you can correct good codes. Yes?
I'm trying to understand the adversarial, the use of the word adversary. Is it because Hamming focused on a minimum distance, whereas Shannon was really conceptualizing an average distance?
That's what we are referring to by adversarial. Somehow the notion that you focus on the minimum of overall possible distances suggests that when you use this theory to say, well, this is the number of errors that you can correct and no more, then you're postulating that somebody can come along, introduce the errors, which will force you to confuse x and y. And the way they'll force you to confuse x and y is they'll take a pair x and a y, which are a distance exactly d, they'll get the sender to send x, and then they'll corrupt it to the string which is exactly in between x and y, exactly halfway in between. Now, the receiver cannot tell whether x was the intended message or y was. And at that stage, this model does not allow d over 2 errors to be corrected. But that assuming you're thinking of the errors as having been introduced by this person who had in its capacity the ability to tell the sender to send x, the ability to introduce errors in exactly the right position, so that the received string looks like the midpoint of x and y. So there's an adversary sitting there introducing the errors, and that adversary can make sure that you cannot correct any more errors than that. The study of error correcting codes led to an easy result which said that if you're trying to transmit if lots of messages, so you have some number of messages which is asymptotically going to infinity, just the number of messages going to infinity, as n goes to infinity, then you better, you're looking at binary strings. What fraction of coordinates could binary strings actually differ in? Well, it's not possible to construct a very large set of strings, which are all binary in nature, and differ in more than half the coordinates. You pick a random string, any pair of random strings will differ and agree in half the coordinates. That's just the nature of the alphabet. So when you're talking about binary strings, you cannot get codes whose minimum distance is greater than n over 2 if you're talking of strings of length n. Okay, so if you give me n plus 1 strings of length n, I'll find for you in that pair, in that collection, two strings whose distance between them is at most n over 2. Okay? Which differ in only n over 2 of the bits. So this is a theorem. What it implies for us is that if you're trying to transmit bits according to the adversarial model, then there will be a pair of strings which differ in only 50% of the coordinates. And in order to confuse the receiver, I don't need to introduce 50% error, I only need to introduce 25% error to take you to the midpoint between these two strings. So in the adversarial channel, you can correct 25% errors. In the probabilistic model of errors, you can correct arbitrarily close to 50% errors. So there is this difference to me is more than just quantitative. It really seems to be somehow qualitatively significant. The fact that in one case, I can use any correlation between the sender and the receiver and work with that to say this is an effective model of communication, to a case where I cannot deal with any correlation, but rather very, very large correlation. So this turns out to be a major difference between these two models. And what I'd like to tell you about is a methodology by which we can try to address the gap between these two things. Do we have to live with this huge gap between the two potential models? One which assumes the errors are oblivious and almost sort of benign, and the other one which says the errors are malevolent, but then you can deal with much, much less errors. So, if we look back to this notion of why are we seeing this gap, it comes up because of this fact that there is this malicious adversary which goes fix the midpoint of two strings X and Y that you might want to transmit and says, now you can't tell between X and Y. One thing we can do is, at least mathematically, we can re-examine this question of whether at this stage we should give up our hands and say we cannot recover any information. Or say, well, maybe there's some weak notion of recovery that we can expect and work with. And one such weak notion proposed in the 50s due to Elias and Wozenkraft was that of list decoding. So here we'll postulate for the time being that the receiver will be willing to live with the following scenario. You give them a broken CD, completely scratched up, and say, well, what was the original data on it? If somebody can come along and give you 10 possible incarnations saying, this CD would have been originally one of these 10 possible channels, had this one of these 10 possible sequences of information, maybe we'll be willing to live with it. If we are, then this is the model that we should be looking at. This model says, well, we broaden the notion of recovery to allow the receiver to work with a small list, to be given a small list saying, one of these was the original message, but we don't know which one. And we'll parameterize the list size by some integer L, and we'll say, well, we'll allow a list of up to L possibilities. And if you allow a list of L possibilities, then we call a code to be PL error correcting if it has an associated decoding algorithm. Not necessarily efficient, just in the sense of being able to, you know, write down a list of L possible candidate messages that might have been transmitted by the sender with the possibility that an adversary came along and adversarially, you know, with absolutely no model-based assumptions, change p fraction of all the bits that were transmitted. Okay? If you have such a code, we call it PL error correcting. So there's a formal definition over here, but I won't go into it, but it can be formalized mathematically. What it says is, well, we should try to build codes which can correct a fraction of p errors using lists of size L. Guaranteed, any time I get a received sequence, I'll be able to look at it, maybe for exponential time, maybe doubly exponential, I don't care, and then come up with a list of L candidates saying one of these was transmitted if the number of errors was less than or equal to P times N. Okay. If you have such a code, we'll call it PL error correcting. And in the notion of the Hamming's notion of an error correcting code corresponds to something like a 1/2 times D over N error correcting code using lists of size 1. So when you have lists of size 1, you can take a code of distance d, it corrects d over n times 1/2 fraction of errors. And this is, yes?
Why is that d minus 1?
It should be d minus 1, yes. I'm ignoring lesser order terms in n. True. Should be d minus 1 over n times 1 half. This is the fraction of error that you're allowed to correct using lists of size 1, but we'll allow larger lists and see if we can get any gains. So how many errors can we correct in this relaxed setting? And guess what? The famed entropy function comes up again. So work in the Russian literature, in particular, lots of people worked on it. Zyablov and Pinsker were one of the many people who wrote about this theme repeatedly. And one of their theorems says that if you want to build codes that are capable of handling p fraction errors, then you can get to a rate of transmission which is 1 minus the binary entropy of p, exactly the same function that Shannon talked about, minus an epsilon, which was also there in Shannon's thing. You could get arbitrarily close to Shannon's capacity, and this epsilon tells you how close to that capacity you can get. And if you, once you fix how close you want to get, there is a certain list size which tells you that you can correct p fraction errors using lists of size f. So you just have to decide, I want to be 1% close to the Shannon capacity. Okay, you have to work with lists of size maybe 1,000. Okay, maybe something like that, maybe it's even worse. But for every constant epsilon that you specify, there's a list. And once you decide to accept this list, you can build codes which are going to correct that fraction of errors. So this, to my taste at least, narrows the graph between these two models. The probabilistic model allows you to flip p fraction of the bits, but they have to be independent and random. The adversarial model allows the adversary to pick p fraction of the bits to flip. The rate you can get in both cases is 1 minus the entropy of p. In this case, you will be able to recover the message uniquely, but you have to trust that this model of errors was very good. You have to make sure that your actual channel is really reflecting your modeling. On the other hand, you could recover a small list, and this will be guaranteed to recover your message, but along with a list of some small size, and you have made no assumptions about this model. So these are very, very, tantalizing options. If you ask me, I would much rather trust this, because if in the end your model is actually fits this case, well, my modeling would still capture it, and what it will tell me is that typically the list that will be output by this algorithm will have size 1. So I would, if I can build codes which work under this model, they would work equally well under this setting, and they would just be dominating. And then, hopefully, we don't have to fine-tune our algorithms so that they are tuned to this particular model of noise and to this particular, all the particular characteristics we associated with the channel. We have a very broad class of channels which is capable of encompassing pretty much everything there. And in the worst case, if all your worst fears are actually true, your lists will be of slightly larger size. That's all. Your decoding algorithm will tell you what was the possibility. So this is the model of recovery that we are advocating. What about algorithmic results? Can you actually build codes and decode them effectively? And strangely enough, this thing was never looked at in the literature on communication itself for the longest of times. In the theory of computer science, this problem started getting some attention due to some work of Levin, and then by Goldreich and Levin, where they started actually giving list decoding algorithms for some very esoteric codes. These codes were such that you would never use them in communication, at least not for the settings of parameters where they could get interesting algorithms. But nevertheless, they started looking at this question of list decoding, gave list decoding algorithms, and suggested looking at other codes for the same purpose. The first interesting polynomial time algorithms for good codes, I would say, came about from some work that we did, and then started receiving a lot of attention in the computer science community, and by now there's a rich literature out there. I've only stated some very early works, but there's an increasing body of literature over here in the last 5 to 10 years. And let me summarize the main result that comes out of it, and then tell you very briefly some of the ideas that go into some of the decoding algorithms. So the main result that we have achieved now is the following. Consider a binary channel which is flipping 1 half minus epsilon fraction of errors. Epsilon is some tiny constant. This is the channel which Shannon says has positive capacity. Shannon's capacity would be something like order of epsilon squared for this channel. So, you know, if you get the closer you get to 50% errors, the less and less capacity you will have, but it will be positive. What we can get is codes of rate omega, of epsilon to the 4th. So something positive, not as large as Shannon promised, in fact, quite a bit worse off. But nevertheless, it's positive, and it says that there are codes whose rate is that much, whose encoding and decoding is polynomial time, and it will come up with lists of size 1 over epsilon to the 4th or some such thing if there are 1 half minus epsilon fraction errors. So under no circumstance will it produce too large a list. If the channel is somewhat more benign, well, the list will be of size 1, and we will be able to achieve that rate. So this is, I would say, the analog of Elias's result in 1955 to Shannon's theorem. So Elias's result to Shannon's theorem and this theorem to the Zamenhof-Pinsker result is probably the rough analogy. So we are at a stage where we can say every channel that has positive capacity can be used with positive rate, but we don't have the right rate yet. There's much more work to be done to get further.
So here the size of the list is clearly a function of epsilon.
The list sizes,
particularly if epsilon is say 1 over some negligible quantity, 1 over 2 would be some quantity. So then the list size would be something of the order of 2 to the something, right?
Sure. The list size would be very large, but notice that even Shannon would not be able to promise you much. If epsilon was extremely small, Shannon's theorem would say, well, you have to take your message and encode it in blocks of size 1 over epsilon to some huge power. So, an inverse dependence on epsilon is natural, is inevitable. In a sense, it's something that we can live with. The list size really is a function of how malicious your model is, your errors are. If your errors are malicious, then the list sizes will be large. If they are not, then the list sizes will not. It has very little to do with this theorem, which says that this is an upper bound of the list size. When you see a list of size even 2, you can conclude at that stage that any probabilistic modeling that you would have done of this channel would have been wrong. If you're getting lists of size 2, there is an adversary sitting somewhere out there, and that's why you're getting lists of even size 2. So the list sizes, I would say, are much more a function of who's the error, introducing the errors, than a function of the theorem, which just gives you an upper bound, says it will never be too bad.
All right, so this is the theorem that I want to talk a little bit about. In order to talk to you about that, I'll try to tell you, Eric, how long should I go? I know I delayed.
Let's go maybe till 12:10.
12:10, okay, sounds good. So I'll tell you a little bit about a family of codes and a list decoding algorithm for these codes. I'll try to make these codes as self-contained as possible and the algorithm as quick as possible. But before I get there, I want to do a little bit of there's always this issue when you introduce a new model of recovery, there's always this question of what do you do with this new model? What do you do with the list of candidates? I wanted a single thing. So our solution so far has been, let's throw the problem at the user. But let me give you a few other options. We don't have to just throw the problem at the user. There are really good, sane engineering reasons for sticking with, to understand this model. The first of which I've already alluded to. If the noise was truly probabilistic, then you can do a probabilistic analysis of the channel and reason that the number of errors would be, the list would be of size 1 with probability close to 1. So what does list decoding bias in the setting? It says there is a single algorithm which would have worked no matter which one of these many probabilistic models you pick. Your model may be changing during your transmission and still the same algorithms are going to work at the senders and receivers end. So you really do not have to fine-tune anything. The second issue over here is that if there was some other way of disambiguating between the transmitted elements and the received elements. For example, you can just, when you're sending the satellite off into space, you can embed in the
satellite some secret random string, extremely small, of length about logarithmic in the size of the transmission that it expects. And that little piece of shared information can be used to disambiguate between this list. So really it's easy to disambiguate elements of the list if you have some channel which can transmit a little bit of information from the sender to the receiver. And this transmission could have happened way before the actual transmission, the actual message was even known to the sender. And this side channel, you can't use it typically because it's extremely expensive to use. The timing constraint says you can't use it at the time that the message is received, but nevertheless you can use, if it exists, then you can disambiguate. This is a notion proposed by Guruswami et al. And a third model, which is actually one of the most convincing ones, is one proposed by Lipton et al. And further refined in some work we did with Nikali et al. Where we feel that, it's okay to model the adversary, the errors to be induced by an adversary, but why should we give away everything to the adversary? In particular, the adversary, no matter how powerful it is probably not going to be able to solve NP-hard problems, probably not going to be able to factor integers. And if such is the case, if there is no natural model of computation physically realized which can in polynomial time factor integers, well then maybe we can use that characterization of nature to restrict our adversary as well. And if you do that, then we can propose ways in which we can use list decoding solutions to make sure that while the adversary could potentially take you to the midpoint between two messages, to do that it would have to solve computationally hard problems. So there are formal theorems along these lines, and I'll point you to some literature where you can find more of this. So that being said, I want to tell you a little bit about how do you ever encode information and how do you actually recover information from these. I want to tell you some of the algorithmic insights. This is part of my passion, so that's the reason why it's being done today. There are many ways of doing list decoding today. This just happens to be my take on it. The way we'll actually... So first I have to tell you a little bit about how you actually encode information. Rather than thinking about bits at this stage, let's start thinking about bytes. So let's say our information is stored as a sequence of bytes, an error would flip one byte to another. Once you start looking at this model of errors, you can actually handle a larger fraction of errors. Okay? A byte being, if you have some correlation between what was written and what was read, what should that translate to? You say, well, it's more than 1 over 256 fractions of the message of what you wrote is intact, then you have correlation between what was written and what you're reading. Okay? So over here you can deal with a large fraction of errors, and that's part of the reason why I'm focusing on this case. How do you typically encode information on your CDs, which actually encode it as a sequence of bytes? Well, you use what's called the Reed-Solomon codes. What are the Reed-Solomon codes? You think of your message, a sequence of, say, 200 bytes, as representing some polynomial. How does it represent a polynomial? You think of a field which has 256 elements, a finite field. If you can't imagine what these are, well, just think of integers modulo 256, roughly, and assume 256 is a prime, that will make it even nicer. So think of some such modular arithmetic where all the nice things that you expect to happen, happen. And so your 200 bytes of information represents some polynomial whose degree is 199. Such a polynomial is given by 200 coefficients, and these coefficients are really your information. This is what you want to transmit from the sender to the receiver. How do you represent this information? Now you stop thinking of it as a sequence of bytes, but think of this algebraic object, single object, a polynomial that you want to transmit. So maybe you want to transmit this pink polynomial to the sender, to the receiver. And how do we do it? The way we do it is, a priori, we'll agree on a sequence of places where you evaluate this polynomial and send me all of these evaluations. So you say, that polynomial evaluated, the first location is this, and the second location is that, the third location is that, the fourth is that. This translates your information from... So if you're looking at a field of size 256, then you evaluated it all the 256 elements. It gives you 256 bytes, while your original information was only 200 bytes. and presumably this is redundant. Is this even good enough? Can you take the 256 elements that you've got at the end and figure out what the polynomial was? Well, the famous interpolation theorem says, well, if I tell you the value of a polynomial at 200 places and the degree of the polynomial is at most 199, I can figure out the coefficients. Great, so we know how to figure out the message given its encoding like this. Well, in fact, it tells you a lot more. It says if I erase a few of these values and I don't tell you what the value here is and I don't tell you what the value there is, but I still give you more than 200 values, you still have enough information to interpolate. So you can deal with up to 56 erasures. A little bit more work tells us that you can actually deal with correct errors as well. And it's that aspect that I want to tell you about. How do you deal with errors in this setting?
I want to tell you an algorithm to deal with errors in this setting. So let me jump to this thing.
So we're working, the error correction problem is the following one. You're given some endpoint, alpha 1, alpha 2, up to alpha 7, which is the set of places that the sender and the receiver agreed a priori, saying, when I have a polynomial, I will evaluate it at these n places and tell you the value at these n places. We need a field to have n distinct values, n distinct points at which I can evaluate them, which is why we had to work with the sequence of bytes. So let's agree that alpha 1 to alpha 7 are the places. I'm the sender, you're the receiver, I'm going to send you the values of a polynomial at alpha 1 to alpha 7. So we're done. I go away, I find my polynomial, and I start transmitting the values. P of alpha 1, P of alpha 2, P of alpha 3, and send n values to you, P of alpha 7. What you receive is some sequence, y1, y2, y3, and so on to y7. They will not always agree with what I intended to transmit because there are errors. So your goal is to find a polynomial whose degree is at most, let's call it k, such that what I transmitted agrees with what you received for many values of I. The classical theory of error correction said, well, you could deal with this problem provided the number of errors was small enough. How small? Less than half the distance. Well, the distance of this, well, these codes can never be more than 100%. So you can deal with about 50% errors. That's the limit. Maximum errors that we will ever deal with is 50%. I'll show you a scheme which will deal with more than 50% errors. Okay? So that should already imply that we can correct a large fraction of errors over here. So we are going to try to solve this problem. You're given n points, alpha 1 to alpha 7, y1 to yn. They come from some finite field with q elements, never mind this notation. And there's a parameter t saying that's the number of places where I expect agreement, number of places which are not in error. This is going to be a very small number, and even though it's a small number, we'll try to solve this problem. And our goal is to find polynomials whose degree is at most k, says that p of alpha I equals yi for many values of I, for at least t values of I. In what follows, in about 10 minutes, I'll try to describe an algorithm to you completely by pictures. And because it's an illustration, it's not the full power of the algorithm, I won't give the pictures for the full description of the algorithm. And to make the pictures nice, I will use k equals 1. Why is this nice? Well, a polynomial of degree 1 is a straight line. So we'll be drawing straight lines in the plane and trying to find these things. So this is a very nice geometric problem,
and we're going to give you an algebraic solution to this geometric problem. And we'll do it on this very special instance of the problem that we work with.
So imagine this is really the problem, you know, encapsulated for you in a very nice example, an instance of the problem. An instance of the problem consists of some number of points on the plane, you know, alpha I, yi. I can write down alpha 1, y1, alpha 2, y2, and so on. I can plot them on the plane. We typically play it over some modular arithmetic and so on, but you could also play this game over the real numbers, and then you would get exactly this kind of a picture. In this example, we have some 14 points on the plane. Our goal is to find straight lines, and let's say we pick the agreement parameter at 5. So we want to find lines which agree with 5 things. The impact of this example is that we're looking at 14 transmissions and expecting 5 agreements. So we are allowing for 9 errors. The amount of errors that you're getting is much more than the amount of non-errors, the amount of agreements. And still we are hoping to recover. Clearly, this kind of choices of parameters allow an adversary to create really, really bad sequences of errors. And you see that here. The solutions, by now most people would have seen this, there's here's one line which passes through 5 points, and here's another line which passes through 5 points. A receiver has no chance at trying to figure out the message uniquely, if that's what it's trying to do, but it can try to find, you know, so what was the potential, what are a list of potential messages, it can try to find it. And we'll show you how to try and solve this problem.
In most of the algebraic algorithms that I encounter, there's always one non-trivial step, okay? And this is the non-trivial step here.
It's almost completely unintuitive, but bear with me while we do this, okay? What we're going to do is, instead of trying to solve the problem at hand, we're going to solve the problem which we know how to solve. So what's the problem that we know how to solve? I'll tell you why we know how to solve this later, but suppose we try and solve this problem and we manage to solve it. What's the problem? Well, we're looking for a polynomial in one variable, p of x, of degree 1, which passes through 5 out of 14 points. We're going to sort of syntactically change everything about this thing. Instead of a polynomial in one variable, I look for a polynomial in two variables. Instead of passing through 5 out of 14 points, I'll ask it to pass through all 14 points. And I will allow its degree to be not 1, but 4. So I'll allow terms of the form x to the 4, I'll allow terms of the form y to the 4, I'll allow terms of the form x squared, y squared, or x times y, etc., etc. All of these terms are allowed. Find a degree 4 polynomial. The only constraint I want to place on it is that it should not be identically 0. But, on the other hand, it should pass through all the points in the following sense. When I look at q evaluated at alpha I, y I, at all the points that are given to me, that should evaluate to 0. So, certainly q of setting all the coefficients of this polynomial to 0 would have worked, and that's the only thing that we are ruling out over here. We don't want to allow that. So suppose we manage to find this point polynomial, and turns out, you know, something like that works. This assumes that this point is the origin, this distance is 1, and that distance is 1, and that this is all a linear transformation of the plane. So let's plot the zeros of this polynomial, and they look like that. So one thing that we see is somehow we looked at this abstract object, this polynomial, and we said, let's plot every pair y1, x1, y1, such that this equation goes to 0, and we find all of these zeros, and we find all of these zeros, and we find all of those zeros.
And what happens algebraically is that we had a polynomial written as a sum of its monomials, but what this picture is saying is that you should be looking at it in its factored form. So you should be writing that polynomial in its factored form. The factors consist of x squared plus y squared minus 1, the circle, y plus x, which is that one, and y minus x, which is that one. And if you write it like that, then it's clear that, you know, the solutions that you're looking for are sitting there. Y plus x is a straight line, y minus x is a straight line, and these are the ones that you're looking for. So once we come up with this sort of a mysterious explanation of this one instance, we can ask questions saying, you know, why did all of this happen? Were we just lucky on this one instance, or was there some theory behind it? And the theory turns out to be extremely simple. Why did this degree 4 polynomial exist? Well, it's a very simple counting argument. When you look at polynomials of degree 4 in two variables, there's actually 15 coefficients that you're looking at. You know, you count all the possible monomials of the form x to the I, y to the j, I plus j is less than or equal to 5, 15 choices of I and j. So you have 15 variables, and what you are imposing as constraints, q of alpha I, y, I equal to 0, when you expand it out, it's a linear constraint in these unknowns. What you don't know are the coefficients, and these constraints are linear constraints in these unknowns. So you have a system of linear equations, 14 equations and 15 unknowns, and these are all homogeneous. Homogeneous meaning if I had set all the q coefficients to 0, then that would have worked as a solution. But we don't want to set all the coefficients to 0. We insist on that. So we are asking for a non-trivial solution to a homogeneous system of linear equations, and that always has a non-trivial solution provided the number of variables is more than the number of constraints. We have 15 variables, 14 constraints, yes we do. So the fact that we found a polynomial which had
satisfied these constraints, that it was a degree 4, passed through 14 points, but was not identically 0, was not a coincidence. It always exists. Unfortunately, this argument basically says if you want to find one passing through 13 points, in fact, there's two solutions, and in fact, there's a two-dimensional space of solutions. Which one of these should we have picked so that these lines would appear in there? The other aspect over here is that actually it doesn't matter which solution you pick if you want these lines to appear. And the reason for that is the following. Consider this line. It's a curve of algebraic degree 1 in the plane. This solution that you found is a curve of algebraic degree 4 in the plane. There is a famous theorem called Bezout's theorem in the plane, which says that if you take two curves whose degrees are d1 and d2, and they have more than d1 times d2 points in common, that means they have some fundamental component in common. A straight line is a component by itself, so the straight line must appear in as a component. What that tells you is that this line must be a factor of any degree 4 polynomial which passes through those 5 points. Okay. If you find any degree 4 polynomial passing through those 5 points, then that line must be there as a factor. So this was not a coincidence, in fact it was to be expected. And together these two sentences are easily generalizable. We can do so, which says basically the counting argument generalizes, scales very nicely. You can try to find, if I give you n points in the plane, there's a curve of degree square root of n and x, square root of n and y, passes through all of the points. And now if you take that curve and you're looking for any polynomial whose degree, is little d, then if they happen to have more than little d times capital D points in common, then this polynomial y minus p of x will divide that. So these two are a fact and they scale very nicely with the degree. Yes, question?
You have to be a little more careful, by the way, because the point can be an infinity and there's no way you're guaranteeing that the field is arbitrary.
Actually, the version of Bezout's theorem that we're using here is the easy direction, supposedly, of Bezout's theorem. It says that the number of intersections cannot be too large.
Right.
There is a hard part of Bezout's theorem which says that if the field is nice.
Right, but what if the points were at infinity, which is not being counted here? So you have to be assuming that you're looking for the lines as the solution, that's why it's working out.
Right, yes, definitely this particular analysis uses the fact that the lines are irreducible, but it just says, well, there are so many points right here in common, there may be others further out that are in common, which we are even ignoring. It already implies what we wish.
Okay. So I can handle that question offline better, I think. All right, so roughly what happens over here is that this,
you can sort of fine-tune this algorithm a little bit and get agreement down. So as presented, dilemmas would combine to say, well, if the number of points of agreement is greater than k, the degree of the polynomial times square root of n, the total number of transmissions, then you can correct errors. Then you can find the polynomial that you were interested in. You can squeeze the k inside the square root by some simple algebraic manipulation. And then a lot of work that we did with Guruswami sort of got rid of this too, gave us a very nice result, but I won't get into it in the limited negative amount of time that I have,
and instead just tell you a little bit about what's been going on since. So this was the algorithm for Reed-Solomon codes that led to the list decoding of some codes.
Using standard techniques in coding theory, one can use this along with standard techniques in coding theory to get the theorem that I described, the one which says that you can transmit at binary, you can construct binary codes which can transmit at positive rates over channels of positive capacity, even allowing for adversarial error. So you can get that easily. But this particular algorithm has some other consequences which were discovered by Kutter and Vardy. And in particular, when we started out with this algorithm, we thought this was something merely of theoretical interest. We can correct lots of errors, but it's a list decoding algorithm in it. Probably much, much more slow. Kutcher and Vardy beefed up the algorithm so that it was really, really running fast. It started competing with, it's competitive with Burlikamp-Massey, which is the standard algorithm in most of your Reed-Solomon code decoders. By the way, every one of you is probably working with one Reed-Solomon decoder or the other at some point or the other, DVD players, CD players, your hard disks on your computer drives, are all encoded with read Solomon codes. The decoders are sort of part of every one of these decoding machines. And they improved, Kutter and Marty sort of started competing with actual algorithms and also found some very nice consequences, side effects that we had not exploited in our own works, where they could sort of look at the decoding problem that a channel typically faces, look at some of the information that we tended to throw away because we were, we just didn't know how to deal with some of the extra information. When you read a byte, you don't get a corrupted byte, you don't just get a vanilla corrupted byte which says, I'm something else, not the what was written, but rather you get some information saying it could have been this, it could have been that, and I think it was sort of likely that the symbol written there was something with probability 80% and something else with probability 10% and maybe these five other things with probability 2% each, something like that. And they could start making use of these kinds of information, and this really sort of beats up actual capacities of actual channels which are being used. There's one example of this decoder actually being deployed where there's this bunch of ham radio experts who are trying to, see how much can they use the ham radio to send signals, how much signal to noise ratio can they achieve from ham radios in all sorts of bizarre circumstances. One of the things that they're trying to do is send signals out to the moon and get it to bounce back and say what kind of signal to noise ratio can you get out of this. So the moon is a very passive player, it just reflects signals, apparently even reflects ham radio signals back to the Earth. But that they're so good at doing that they now want to do it out of comet trails. And comet trails are a little bit more flaky, but you can imagine that we are getting to a point where the signal to noise ratios are getting pretty low. And they're getting a noticeable gain. I don't know what these numbers mean, but they get a noticeable gain by using this version of the Reed Solomon decoding algorithm over there. So, A, the very fact that they can run this algorithm and get it to, work within their time frame is very significant, and it's actually giving them effective gains. So that's roughly what turned out as a side effect from the list decoding thing. So I'll conclude now and just say that, so what I was hopefully trying to say is that list decoding is a meaningful, useful, and feasible notion of error correction. It takes us away from the standard paradigm where communication had been stuck, where we were looking at a few algorithms and fixing them and trying to vary a lot of codes around them. It is possible to vary algorithms. The state of algorithmic research is at a sufficiently mature point now that we can really think of algorithms as variables and vary them to the extent that Shannon and Hamming would have liked us to. And there's a lot of theoretical consequences to the fact in computer science, starting with the work of Goldreich and Levin, to the fact that we can actually deal with positive correlation between the sender and the receiver, even when the adversary is malicious. This has major cryptographic implications, and that's already being used in the theoretical computer science. I think the main challenge ahead is to find more practical uses. I mean, quite often we take a certain threshold on the amount of error that we can correct as a fixed point, and we say, well, we'll design all our engineering systems subject to this limitation of the amount of errors. Now that that threshold is moving, shouldn't we sort of rethink what kinds of, how densely you pack information in your CDs and your DVDs? Because these are all questions that can be re-examined under this context as well.
Feasible, but may not be realistic. I mean, in the sense, you can do good proof theorems, but,
somebody trusts that, you know, people are not buffering your entire messages when they are doing that. So, and modulo that, we'll have to prove limits of the time, you know, in so much space, you cannot figure a nearby thing, which is even harder to prove maybe than to say that for long in time, you cannot figure out a nearby.
About the causality bounded adversaries. So the causality bounded adversaries, in the sense that the Shannon theory is sort of putting things in witness weight. They having the logic of the whole message of insight in the location.
Sure.
Both as you're saying it, you're online determining, do I want to use one of my deep weapons? You may have a small
question. Oh, that's an excellent question. If you're online and trying to figure out and you haven't seen the entire message, and you haven't in particular given the message to the sender to be transmitted, then indeed you can get more. The nice thing is, at this state, at least we seem to be seeing that all you need to assume about this adversary is that it's computationally bounded. I see. So causality bounded, you're thinking of it in as an incomparable.
It's allowed to do arbitrary computation.
It's allowed to do arbitrary computation, but it's online. Excellent question.
I perhaps looked at two channels.
I'm not familiar with that.
Lipton has you sending it two different ways, and the adversary is only
allowed to
independently on both channels.
Sure, that's a good point. I guess even now that you mentioned that,
but isn't that also a version of the complexity bounded adversary? Because typically, in a complexity bounded situation, the adversary does have a choice of looking at what has happened in the past and adapting what his next query is also going to be. So is that going to be covered in the causality bounded situation? Because, for example, in the cryptographic situation, the adversary is able to look at what the results are, and then his role is to figure out whether it was black box 1 or black box 2.
Well, I'm saying that you can perhaps get rid of all computational bounds by just saying that, you know, you can't decide, knowing what's going to be sent.
I think that's an excellent question. I am not sure. Maybe it is addressed by some of the literature. I cannot figure that out online. But it certainly merits examining. I think a causality bounded adversary model could work very well. There are some cases where, of course, it wouldn't capture what's happening. Because, the adversary in nature could once again buffer messages up to a certain limit,
except
and
look ahead.
And so you would sort of allow causality with a limited look ahead, and that would work potentially also, but